Thank you all for coming out. It's good to see that extra credit means every bit as much here as at every other college and university in the United States. And for those who came from off campus, thank you as well for coming out. We don't have a lot of time. We have enough, but not so much that we can waste a lot of it with formalities. So I will thank those who were involved in making it possible for me to come to your campus this evening. And then I will start the way I do lately, which is by telling you that I think it's always a matter of really good advice when somebody stands up in front of you and is proclaimed to be an expert on something, whether it is an outside speaker like myself, or whether it is a professor in one of your classrooms, or whether it's a politician or a talking head on a television show trying to tell you what to think about something, that it's probably a good practice to get into to ask yourself, if not out loud to others, why is it that I'm listening to this person and not any number of other people to whom I could be listening? Because the reality is, regardless of the issue, not just race and racism, but regardless of the issue, the reality is that the person in front of you is not necessarily the most qualified person to give the talk. I mean, they obviously have got some credentials, or at least we hope they wouldn't be there. But the idea that somehow the reason you're listening to the speaker, or the reason you're listening to the professor, or the reasoning you're listening to the so-called expert on television is because they are, in fact, the most informed person is not always accurate. My mother would certainly love for you to believe that the reason you're listening to me tonight is because I'm just the brightest bulb in the box when it comes to the issue of racism in America, because that's how moms are, man. If moms can content themselves with the idea that you're really the best that there is, then that reflects well on them. But the reality is that that wouldn't be an accurate reflection at all. There are plenty of people of color, for example, millions indeed, virtually any person of color in this country, in fact, could get up on this stage or any of the other 80 to 90 stages that I speak from every single year and give this talk or one very, very close to it and have it be every bit as expert, in fact, quite a bit more so, because folks of color, unlike myself as a white man, have to understand what racism is as a matter of survival. I get to do it somewhat second and third hand. Right? And yet they could get up and give the same talk every bit as well and not be taken one half as seriously, one third as seriously, one tenth as seriously. And so at the outset of my talks, I like to put people on notice that that is the case, to make sure that you know, and to make sure that you know that I know, that the real evidence of our progress in this country, evidence which is certainly as of now not in evidence, that we've made real progress, will be that day when a person of color can stand up and say all the things that I'm about to say in the course of the next hour and be taken as seriously as I expect to be taken, and given my experience doing this work, know full well that I will be taken. Because unfortunately, when folks of color talk about racism, just like when women talk about sexism, just like when a person who's poor or lower moderate income talks about economic injustice, we tend to dismiss that, because we assume that that person has some ulterior motive for making the argument that they're making. But truth is either true or it's not. It is not any more true because I say it. It is not any less true because a person of color says it. And so, although I'd love for you to believe that the reason I'm here is just because I know that much more, the reality is most everything I ever learned about racism and most of the things that I know about the subject which I'll share with you this evening are the collected wisdom of people of color shared with me over very many years, sometimes patiently and sometimes not so patiently, and I'm glad to reflect that back to you this evening, but let us at least be clear about where the wisdom comes from. Indeed, all of those accomplishments that you heard about at the outset in the bio that was read to you, all of those accomplishments are not about my superior intellect or my superior ability. They are indeed about being white and almost no other thing. Were I not white, I would not be here standing in front of you giving this talk this evening. How do I know that? It's really very simple. You see, I've been doing anti-racism work for 16 years. I've been on the road lecturing full-time and doing seminars and workshops for 12 of those 16 years. Now, some speakers don't like to date themselves and tell you how old they are, but in my case, it will make a point that I need to make. I'm 38 as of last month, which means even if you're not good at math, you can count backwards enough at least that much to know that I've been doing this work since I was 22 and doing it at a fairly high level of national prominence. How in the world does somebody at the age of 22, 23, 24, 25 gain the level of recognition to allow them to get out and speak about a subject that people of color have been speaking about to no avail in terms of the white audience's ears for generations and for centuries. Well, once again, my mother notwithstanding, it is not because of superior talent. It is because immediately after college, the very first job I had was doing anti-racism work at a very high level. I was the associate director of the largest anti-racism group in the state of Louisiana, which that very year, 1990, had as its primary responsibility derailing and defeating the political candidacy of David Duke, who was running for the United States Senate. For those who do not know who David Duke is, he is probably this nation's most prominent overt white supremacist, former head of the largest Ku Klux Klan group in the United States, and I would call him a neo-Nazi, but that would be giving David credit for having thought of something new, since neo implies new, and David is sort of old school Nazi. For those who are geologists in the room, that would be either Jurassic or Paleolithic Nazi. I'm not really sure which, but I'm sure you will fill me in on the details as we go along. And so it was my job, along with several others of us, to make sure that David Duke, this overt racist, did not become the United States Senator from the state of Louisiana, which he almost did, I should point out, receiving 44% of the overall vote, which is to say 60% of the white vote. Had it been up to white folks in Louisiana, we would have had a Nazi, a former Klansman, an overt racist as the United States Senator. The next year, even after he lost that, he ran for governor and got 55% of the white vote. So he would have been governor as well, and it certainly wasn't because people didn't know his background. They were fully aware of it, and his background gave him street cred with people who frankly wanted to vote for someone who was a racist. So doing that work at a very high level of national prominence, I mean, it was big media, not just U.S. media, but globally. Being in the midst of that gave me an elevated level of legitimacy as a spokesperson on these issues, so my voice, right, was broadcast to millions of people. It wasn't about being any better at it than anyone else. I was in the right place at the right time. And how'd I get that job? Because that is sweet work to get right out of college, man. I hope for your sake that when you get out of college, you'll get a job that's sweet. But don't count on it, because it doesn't happen that often. But it did happen to me. Why? Well, it's real simple. I got the job the old-fashioned way, which is to say that I knew the two guys who started the organization, and one of them was a history professor, the other a grad student friend, and they offered me the job, the old-fashioned way that we get work in this country. And I took the job, and I guess I did a good job at it, but that really wasn't the point, because it begs the question, how did I know these men? If I don't know them, I don't get the job. I only knew them because I'd gone to Tulane University in New Orleans, which happened to be where they were. Had I gone to any other school in this country, any other school on the planet, I wouldn't have been in a position to know them, for them to offer me the job, get that job, fight David Duke, build up a national reputation, and end up on the lecture circuit and ultimately come before you this evening. But how did I end up at Tulane? Because Tulane was then and is now an extremely expensive institution of higher learning, and my family was then and is now exceptionally broke. And how do broke people go to such expensive institutions? Now, I know what you're thinking, because you're doing it, right? You are thinking to yourself, well, damn, fool, you just do what we did, which is you take out loans that you'll be paying off for the next 20 or 30 years. It's easy, man. You just go into debt forever like we did, and that's really good advice. But here's the point where I'm going to speak of myself in the third person, because it's less embarrassing this way. Tim Wise has a problem. And Tim Wise's problem is procrastination. So I screwed around and got my financial aid forms in like 5.5 months too late, or something god-awful like that. Now, what do you think happens when you get your financial aid forms in? I hope you don't know from firsthand experience. What do you think happens when you turn in your aid forms that late? Well, they send you a really nice letter about 6 weeks before it's time for you to show up on campus. And the letter says something to the effect of this. Well, we're really looking forward to having you come in late August. That's why we let you into this place. But here's the deal. We don't have much money left for you because you got your aid forms in too late. We got like $7,000. Well, we hope you can find the other 10, because it was going to cost only $17,000 that year. That, of course, cheap by today's standards, but this was 1986 dollars after all. $17,000, they were going to offer 7. Now, keep in mind, I said that we were a broke family. I lived in an apartment my entire life growing up. We did not own a home, never owned a home, lived paycheck to paycheck, didn't take vacations, drove cars until they stopped running, only had one car between the entire family. So we had no assets. We had no credit that wasn't bad credit. We had no collateral. What in the world does a family do when they got to come up with $10,000 so their kid can go to Tulane, meet those men, get that job, fight David Duke, build up that national reputation, and end up on the lecture circuit and ultimately here at Fisher this evening? Well, easy. My mom goes down to the bank and gets a loan for $10,000. But that is one hell of a trick, because banks are not in the habit of giving broke people $10,000. There's just nothing in it for them. So why in the world would they do that? Simple. My mom was able to take her mom, my grandmother, down to the bank, and my grandmother could co-sign the loan for my mother using her house as collateral so that if my mom defaulted on the loan, they could take her home. It was the fourth home that my grandmother had owned with her husband, who'd been dead for 6 years by that point, in a neighborhood where the demand for housing was very high and the property values were always going up as a result, and it was a nice place to live. And just in case you hadn't figured it out, it was the fourth house they had owned in a neighborhood where there were no people of color around, and this was not by accident. This was the result of very deliberate policies, practices, and procedures that had screened out people of color and guaranteed they would not live there, keeping in mind that housing discrimination had been fully legal in this country until 1968. And even 20 years after the Fair Housing Act, we know that there were almost no enforcement mechanisms in that law. And even today, there are 2 to 3 million cases of racial housing discrimination a year, according to federal estimates. So needless to say, this was a house that, had my family not been white, we would not have owned. Not that house, and not any house even remotely like it in all likelihood, with which we would then not have been able to get the $10,000. Because we wouldn't have had the house to put up as collateral. I wouldn't have been able to go to Tulane, meet those men, get that job, build up my reputation as an anti-racist, and end up in front of you here this evening, which is a roundabout but important way of telling you that I, like anyone else in this country, I am where I am because I'm good at what I do, but also because of the social context into which I was born. And this is true for all of us. And in this country, that is a social context of institutional racism. Whether we use the term or not is not the point. It is a context of racialized privilege for those of us who have the luxury of being called white and thought of as white in this culture. It is a social context that allowed one side of my family, the MacLeans of Western Scotland, to enter this country in the 1750s before it even was a country, and within 10 years of being here, to obtain over 10,000 acres of land in what would become North Carolina, what would become Tennessee, what would become Kentucky, land that African-descended people had been working on for a century and a quarter, unable to even own their own name, let alone the land on which they were working, land that had been lived on since time immemorial from indigenous persons of this continent, who were certainly not going to be allowed to keep it, but the MacLeans of Western Scotland, yes, indeed, just by virtue of our whiteness, would be able to lay claim to 10,000 acres of it for no reason other than our race. It is a social context that allowed the other side of my family, the Russian Jewish immigrant side that didn't even come here until the early 1900s, and no doubt faced discrimination because of religion, and no doubt faced discrimination because of ethnicity and nationality and lack of English language skills, and yet my great-grandfather, nonetheless, able to get jobs the first day off the boat in New York City that were off limits to people of color. Indeed, his very ability to enter the United States in the early 1900s and catch all that hell that he caught as a Russian Jewish immigrant was itself dependent on whiteness, because from the 1880s, really until 1965, this country had in place intense immigration restrictions that pretty much made it impossible for anyone who was not of European descent to even come here. So when we hear the stories of Russian Jews and Italians and Irish Americans who came and only had 13 cents and a ball of lint in their pockets and worked hard and caught hell and nonetheless made their way up the ladder, let us keep in mind that it was their whiteness and nothing else that allowed them to even get here and to catch that hell and to work hard and to build their fortune, if you will, or at least their opportunity in the next generation. So that too was contingent upon whiteness. Why do I tell you all this as a way of introducing the subject this evening? Well, I do it because it's important to be honest, both individually and collectively, about who we are and how we got here. Too long, we have believed in a lie, and we have taught that lie to our children. and we continue to tell it to ourselves. And that lie is the lie of meritocracy, this idea that if you just work hard, you'll make it. If you made it, it's because you worked hard. If you didn't make it, it's just because you didn't work hard enough and you ought to work harder. But we know it's not accurate. First of all, the reason we know it's not accurate, if we're being honest, is, among other things, that we've all known people who've worked hard every day of their lives and remained stuck at the bottom of the class structure, irrespective of their effort. And we know people who were born on third base, think they hit a triple, and haven't really done a damn thing, but are never going to actually fall back in the class structure either. We also know it because statistically the evidence is overwhelming. The wealthiest 1% of Americans today owns 46% of all the financial assets in the country. That is to say, the easily disposable assets, commercial real estate, stocks, bonds, etc. The top 1%, roughly 2.8, 2.9, maybe 3 million people, owning 46% of all the financially disposable wealth and assets, the easily disposable financial assets. 30 years ago, they only owned 24%. Which means that if you believe meritocracy is real, you would have to actually believe that the wealthiest, say, 2.8, 2.9 million people almost doubled their work effort in the last 30 years so as to justify getting all that extra stuff. But anybody who believes the richest Americans really doubled their work effort in the last 30 years is high as a kite. There isn't any logic to it. In fact, I should point out, Labor Department data suggests that those at the top of the class structure actually reduced their hours of work per week over the last 30 years. Those at the bottom increased their hours of work per week, and yet they saw their share of the stuff diminish. So we don't only not live in a meritocracy, we live perhaps in the exact opposite of that, given the actual data that we see. But we continue to say it. In spite of this historically embedded structure of inequality, which has given some of us a head start and others of us headwinds against which we labor. The story I told you at the outset is not only my story. If it were, I wouldn't have shared it with you. It would have been purely self-indulgent, and I wouldn't have wasted either of our time. But the reality is it's not just my story. It is the story, to some extent, of every white American in this country. Anyone in this country who can go by the title of white and be perceived as white, who was born before 1964, by definition and by law and without exception, was elevated above every person of color in this country prior to that time. There is not a single exception to it. It is not an arguable point. And anyone who is descended from those who prior to 1964 were in this country and capable of being called white has reaped the benefits of that intergenerational head start. And so as a result, we can say that this story extends to more than just me and my family. There are several examples we could speak of. Let me just give you two. The first, the Homestead Act of 1862, which redirected over 240 million acres of land, most of it west of the Mississippi, to over 70 million white families. Actually, I should say 70 million white Americans is how many live on that land today. With several dozen million who actually got the land. Today, there are 70 million Americans living on land that they would not be living on were it not for their white skin, because the government would not, in fact, enforce the homestead claims of persons of color under that government program. It was a government redistribution of wealth program, a government program that, if it had benefited black people, we'd call it welfare. If it had benefited black people, we'd call it affirmative action. If it had benefited people of color, we would call that racial preference. But because it benefited whites, we look at it fondly as positive macroeconomic policy. Or from the 1930s to the 1960s, when the federal government began to guarantee home loans under the FHA program and the VA program, two programs that were not in fact universal, not in fact based on credit rating, not in fact based on collateral, not in fact based on whether you'd been a veteran or not, but were programs that used an underwriting criteria that pretty much guaranteed only white folks and white families were going to be able to get these loans. Government guaranteed loans, guaranteed by the taxpayers of the country, including taxpayers of color, but they couldn't take advantage of the programs. And so for the first 28 years of the FHA loan program from 34 to 62, the government underwrote $120 billion with a B dollars worth of housing equity, almost none of it to anyone who wasn't white. Today, there are perhaps 30, 40, 50 million white folks living in houses, inheriting houses that they wouldn't have had access to had it not been for whiteness. That is just two programs alone. And those two programs alone have directly benefited more than half of all the white Americans in this country. maybe as many as 60 or 65%. This is one of the reasons that today the average white family in this country has 11 times the accumulated net worth of the average black family, 8 times that of the average Latino family. It is not because of harder work effort. It is not because of higher savings rates. It is not because of superior morality or ethics. It is entirely because of racial privilege. And it's important to point this out because it allows us, I hope, to avoid the innocence trap that we fall into when we talk about racism in this country. And that trap is the one whereby white folks will say, oh, I know it's really terrible all this stuff happened. It's awful. I wish it hadn't, but I didn't do it. I didn't own any slaves. Yeah, I know how damn old you are. Can we just leave that for another day? I didn't kill any Indians. That was my great-granddaddy. I didn't take half of Mexico in a war we started. That was somebody else. I didn't lock up Japanese Americans. Yeah, no crap. I know how old you are, and it's not the point. If you inherit the legacy of that which has come before, then you have some accountability and responsibility to address it. Because just like we as white folks in this generation and the generation, I say we, who am I kidding? I'm 38. Okay, I realize it's a different generation now. But the white folks in your generation and my generation who didn't do the thing, by the same token, black and brown folks didn't do the thing that has allowed them to inherit the deficit either. Right? That is to say, if this current generation of white folks isn't responsible, then this current generation of black and brown folks sure as hell isn't responsible, but they inherit the legacy of all that has come before. So why in the world do we think that we don't inherit the legacy as well? Inertia is not just a concept of the physical universe, a property of physics. It is also a property of the socioeconomic universe. That which happens before continues to reap its legacy today. It's not like a video game where we can hit restart and start the game over again because the first game didn't end up the way we felt it should have. It's sort of like viewing history as an intergenerational poker match, right? If you think about American history in that way, go back 15 generations or whatever it is, and you got all these poker players sitting around the table, and at the beginning, the white player continually cheats every other player of color. No one would argue that's what the game was like. We all would be on the same page there. We'd all say, sure, we know the white player was cheating all the time. We all agree with that. No argument. Let's say that history is an intergenerational poker match, though, and at the end of the first generation, the first white player who was cheating passes down all of his chips that he's accumulated to the second generation white player, and that player cheats all the players of color. And then they die and pass the game off to their kids, and the third white generation player cheats and dies and passes the game to his kid, and pretty soon, 13 or 14 generations later, finally, the great-great to the nth degree grandchild of the first cheating white guy says, okay, enough is enough. I realize that my great-great to the nth degree granddad that he was really doing your people wrong. It was terrible, isn't it, that he cheated you that way? And so I'm here to announce that from this day forward, there will be no more cheating. From this day forward, we're only going to play by one set of rules. Isn't that great? Would we be surprised that the black and brown players around the table might look and say to themselves, well, now, yes, I guess that's good, and we're glad that you don't intend to cheat us anymore, but might we have a conversation about all the chips on your side of the table? And then the white player, of course, would say, no, we can't talk about that because I didn't steal those chips. That was my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaddy. I'm not responsible, so I'm gonna keep the stuff if that's all the same with you. That would be absurd, and yet that's what we do in this country, not recognizing the intergenerational advantage that the dominant group has had, even though we would recognize it in the case of a poker match, and we would realize how ridiculous it was to claim innocence in a society where the horses are, as the old saying goes, out of the barn and have been for some time. Of course, the problem is that this isn't just a past issue. If it were, maybe we could relegate it to a history class, but indeed it continues today. Now, we in the white community don't like to believe that. In fact, we steadfastly don't believe it. If you look at the polls that have been done of white American racial opinion, you'll find that white Americans are convinced that racism, though a problem in the past, is no longer a problem now. Several years ago, a survey was done where white Americans were asked, do you believe that racial discrimination against folks of color is still a significant national problem? And only 6% of us said yes, 6 out of 100. Just to give you an idea of how pathetic that is, I would have you compare it to a poll taken about 2 years earlier where 12% of white Americans said that we believed there was a fairly decent chance Elvis Presley might still be alive. So for those of you who aren't real hot with mathematical ratios and probability statistics, right, what that means is that white Americans are roughly twice as likely to believe that Elvis is still alive than we are to believe what people of color tell us they experience on a fairly regular basis. That is a level of delusion so profound as to boggle the mind, but there it is. People who are otherwise rational, decent human beings, I'm quite sure, believing that what people of color say is true isn't true, which really is a form of racism, because if people of color are suggesting this indeed is happening to them regularly, and we as white folks are saying, no, not really, right? That's fundamentally racist. That's like saying, you're not smart enough, you're not rational enough, you're not objective enough, you're too emotional. You can't actually understand what's happening to you, so don't trust your own experience, trust me. I'll tell you what your life is like. It's not about racism. You don't really face discrimination. How do I know? I just know. I know you think you do, but you're crazy. We don't have to say that, but that's the impression we give. Oh, you're playing the race card. Can we please clear up one thing real quickly? What kind of card is that? Like, you know, really, I mean, if we know anything about cards, like, what the hell kind of card is that? Like, you don't play a card unless it's a good one, you know, that's like gonna win the hand. When was the last time the race card won black and brown folk a damn thing? Like, when was the last time you saw black and brown folk that were like, oh, you thought you had me, but here is the race card. And then white people said, damn it, oh. Boy, until you played that one, I had you, but now I must bow to your superior wisdom. This doesn't happen. This is like the two of diamonds. I mean, this doesn't trump anything. This card gets its ass kicked in every game. Because when a person of color brings it up, immediately they get jacked, they get attacked, they get criticized. So it's not much of a card. And unless you think people of color just have some masochistic streak playing a hand that they know isn't gonna get them a damn place, right? You'd have to think it's pretty silly for anyone to just pull it out of their ass like it was really gonna be the winning hand. You know, it's just nonsensical. But the reality is that this denial on the part of white America, it isn't new. And so I'm getting ready to say something which, in spite of everything I've said before, some of which you'll agree with and many of you will disagree with, that's fine. You're free to agree or disagree with anything I say tonight, but my guarantee is that this next thing I'm gonna say, none of you are gonna disagree with, because, you know, you just can't and be even remotely intellectually honest. This next thing is totally uncontroversial today. It wasn't a long time ago, but here's the statement. Radical though it may seem, in 1962 and 1963, people of color were treated profoundly unequally in the United States. Anyone really want to take issue with that? Probably not, because you know that in 62 and 63, of course people of color were treated unequally. It was before the Civil Rights Act, before the Voting Rights Act, before the Fair Housing Act, so we all know, like, regardless of ideology, we're all going to be on the same page. But now here's the funny thing. If you go back to 1962 and 63, and you look at the opinion surveys that were done in white America at the time, not today, when we can look back 40 some odd years in the past and say, oh, it was terrible, because it's no sweat off our back to say that now. Go back to 62 and 63 and look at what otherwise rational white people in this country were saying when they were asked, do you believe that there is equal opportunity in this country? Because when the Gallup poll asked that question of white Americans and said, do you believe, for example, that black people are treated equally in your community, in 1963, 75% of white Americans said, sure, absolutely they are. What a silly question. And in 1962, when white folks were asked, do you believe that blacks have equal educational opportunity in your community, 85% of white Americans said, absolutely. It's 1962, my God. We've conquered all of those horrible things. Now, the 1930s, ooh, those were rough. But I'm sure if you went back to the 30s, what would they have said? They would have said, oh, the 1890s, those were a bitch. But, you know, here we are in the 1930s, everything's better now. And I know what happens if you go back to the 1890s and you look at what the newspaper reporters would write and the editorialists. They would write, oh, we don't have a problem with our Negroes. We get along just fine. If you Yankees would just leave us alone. See, in every generation, white America's had the luxury of not knowing the truth or not caring. So you go back to the 1850s, and Dr. Samuel Cartwright, a very well-respected physician in the southern states, actually coined a phrase for what he called the mental illness that caused black people to run away from slavery. right? That's how bad racism wasn't. It's not a bad thing. Black people are insane. They actually run away from their masters. So he coined a phrase called drapetomania. That was the word to describe the insanity that caused black people to run away from bondage. So and white folks were like, absolutely, that makes perfect sense. You'd have to be crazy to not want to be a slave. Who's crazy here, right? But the dominant group had the ability to pin the label of insanity on those who were being oppressed, not even realizing how insane it was to actually make that kind of an argument. So the dominant group has had the luxury every generation of not knowing the truth. Not because we're bad people, by the way. I think most white folks are decent, intelligent, caring people, but we've been so insulated from black and brown truth. Right? Because 85% of white Americans live in communities with almost no people of color around. So even if we're caring, decent, wonderful, loving people who would never deliberately seek to racially oppress anyone, if we don't see the oppression, because it's not happening right in front of us, it's not happening in our institution, in our neighborhood, we're not seeing it very regularly with our own eyes, then it becomes easy to do that whole out of sight, out of mind thing where if we're not seeing it, it must not be happening. And so when someone says it is, we have to assume they're exaggerating. We have that luxury of not knowing black and brown truth because we're not tested on it. Right? What happens to white Americans if we don't know what people of color experience? Not a damn thing. But people of color have to know our reality. Hell, they will be tested on that from the time they're very young. They got to learn white history, white art, white literature, white theater, white poetry. I know we don't call it that. That's the beauty of being the dominant group. You don't have to call it white history, right? It's just the default position to which we go whenever we're not labeling it black history. We got all these tricky names for White History Month. We call it May and June and July and August and all that. That doesn't change the reality of what it is we're learning. When you're the dominant group, you don't have to racially specify your thing. Your thing is just the norm. It gets taken for granted, you see, and people of color will be tested on it because if they don't learn the white narrative, if they don't learn the white reality, they will fail out of school. They will have a very hard time surviving in this society because if you want to succeed, given the power structure, you got to come through white folks. It's like that kid that sees dead people in the movie The Sixth Sense. If you're black or brown in this country, you see white people because we're like Visa. We're every damn place you want to be. That's the power of being the dominant group. And what's the actual evidence? It's very clear. The evidence is really incontestable. A few examples. Black youth arrested for drug possession on a first offense with absolutely no prior arrest whatsoever, 48 times more likely than white youth to be incarcerated, even when the circumstances of the arrest are exactly the same, when the prior records are exactly the same, when there is nothing to distinguish the incidents other than race, the black youth 48 times more likely to be incarcerated for a drug possession offense. When resumes are sent out that have stereotypically white names, they have a 50% greater chance of getting a call back for an interview, according to a huge national study conducted by economics professors at MIT and the University of Chicago, a 50% greater chance if you have a white-sounding name of getting called back for an interview than if you have a black-sounding name, even when all of the credentials, the merit, the qualifications, the experience are indistinguishable. An important point for two reasons. One, it suggests ongoing discrimination against folks, in this case, who were thought of as black, and I assure you, if you did the same study with white folks and Latinos or white folks and Arab Americans right about now, I have very little doubt that the outcomes would be similar, if not identical. But it also suggests ongoing privilege for the dominant group, right? And it also does a lot to dismiss this idea of reverse discrimination, because God knows if, in fact, the American labor market were filled with reverse discrimination, if it were true that white guys just couldn't get work because black people were getting all the goodies, which is so preposterous that it's almost absurd to contemplate, and yet people believe it sometimes, apparently. If that were true, this would have been the perfect study to prove it, man, because the personnel director could have gone into the office on Monday, opened the P.O. box, pulled out the resumes, and been, hot damn, Tamika has applied for the job. Thank God. We've been waiting for Tamika for like months, man. And what'd you say? Jamal sent the resume in? Hell yes. Get Jamal in here. But what'd you say her name was? Jenny? Oh, hell no. I'm pretty sure she's white. And Skylar? White. Chloe, white. Chuck, white. I need Andre. I'm making fun of it only to suggest how absurd it is. And yet this idea that white folks are getting screwed over for the benefit of people of color continues to persist in spite of evidence such as that, or evidence from a study that came out a year later which found that white men who have prior criminal records actually have a better chance of getting called back for an interview than black men without a record, even when all credentials are indistinguishable. The fact that black and Latino males are 3 times more likely to have their cars stopped and searched by police looking for narcotics, even though white males are 4 times more likely to actually have drugs in our car. Now think about this. Black and Latino folks 3 times more likely to get stopped, white folks more likely, 4 times more likely to be guilty, suggesting that racial profiling is not just racist, it is stupid-ass law enforcement. Or is it? It's only stupid if you think the purpose of the war on drugs is actually to get drugs. But that's a very open question, because I got news for you. It ain't about that. The Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes on Drug Abuse, and every source you choose to consult will indicate to you that, contrary to stereotype, white Americans are equally or more likely to use every single category of illegal narcotic than are African American folks or Latinos. White folks are 74% of all illegal drug users in this country. Black folks are 13%. Latinos are 10%. Combined, Latinos and black folks, 23% of the users, 90% of the people who get locked up in a given year for a drug possession offense. White folks, 74% of the users, less than 10% of the people who get locked up in a given year for a possession offense. So it's not about drugs, unless you believe that cops are just so stupid that they keep forgetting what the data tells them. Like they keep pulling over black folks and then they smack themselves in the forehead. Damn, I forgot. It's white people with the drugs. Oh, I stopped another person named Martinez. What's wrong with me? I need to put a post-it note on my dashboard that reminds me that it's white people, white people, white people. Why can't I remember that, you know? But do we really think that it's just that level of stupidity? Why is it that when I do trainings with law enforcement and I ask them in the first 90 seconds, 2 questions. Question number 1, what's the first thing you think when you see a young black or Latino male driving a nice car in your community, and they all say without hesitation, drug dealer? And then I ask them, what's the first thing you think when you see a young white man, same age, driving a similarly nice car in your community? And they all say, without hesitation, spoiled little rich kid, daddy bought him a car. These are people whose cars on the side, on the door, say, to protect and serve. And they've taken an oath to treat people equitably. And within a minute and a half of our time together, they have just admitted to their own racial biases. And we still got 2 hours of workshop left. What does that tell you? These are folks who honestly believe one thing, even though the data suggests, not only with regard to drug use, but with regard to drug dealing, that white folks, especially among youth, are equally or more likely to be dealers than black folks are. Again, contrary to stereotype, but that is what the research data suggests very clearly, and which the Justice Department has published for years. So that is not only discrimination against people of color, it's privilege for white folks. I will tell you right now from firsthand experience, if the war on drugs was about drugs, you'd be listening to somebody else tonight. But I'm fairly confident it wasn't about that, because the war on drugs didn't come to the 8th floor of Monroe Hall at Tulane University between the fall of 1986 and the spring of 1987, specifically rooms 804 and 213. And I, for one, am grateful. They were too busy arresting black people in New Orleans who made the mistake of doing their drugs somewhere other than my dorm room, silly people. They had just come uptown to my room, everything would have been fine. I'm not trying to romanticize drug use, by the way, I'm just reminiscing. And I can only tell you this because the statute of limitations has expired. But that's the point. It isn't about who does the crime, but it is very much about who does the time, and those two things are not at all the same. But it's not just the material privileges that come with being a member of the dominant group. It's not just better job and housing opportunities or better treatment in the justice system. It's also the psychological privilege we want to confront. And this is actually bigger in some ways than the material privilege, because it leads to material privilege, actually dovetails with material privilege, but it also exists independent of it. It's the psychological advantage for those of us in the dominant group not having to worry about the need to overcome negative stereotypes whenever we're in a situation of being evaluated, whether it's applying for a job or taking a test in a class or raising our hand to answer a question in a classroom. Never worrying that if we get the answer wrong, that people are going to think that reflects badly on white people as a group. Not worrying that when we're in that interview or trying to get a loan from a bank, that someone is going to look at us and think that our race is evidence of bad credit or that our race is evidence of inferior intellect or less ability. But that is something people of color do indeed sweat on a regular basis because of race. Unless we as white folks are applying for jobs that involve jumping or dancing, what the hell stereotypes are we really up against? Not many. But for folks of color, they go a little bit deeper than that. Now, of course, white women certainly experience that same concern on a gender level, so that white women know that if they mispronounce a word, if they answer an interview question anything less than brilliant, that it could reflect badly on them as women. But in terms of race alone, people of color face this burden quite by themselves. And those of us who are white have one less thing to sweat when we're in that interview session, when we're in that classroom, not worried that we have to represent for our entire group. Because if we're in a classroom, unlike people of color, when they're one of one, one of two, one of three people, and race comes up and all eyes turn to them. Because, of course, we just know all the black folks can speak for all the black folks, and all the Latinos can speak for all the Latinos, and the Asian Pacific Americans had a damn email tree that went out on Wednesday where they said, now look, y'all, if the white people want to know about this, this is what we're going to tell them, right? There is no unanimity of opinion among peoples of color, but sometimes they do feel that burden of representation, worried that if they do badly in a class, that it won't be their own failure, that it will be seen as a failure of the group. But we who are white don't worry about that. Here's how I know we don't. Because white folks can do some stupid stuff, and it won't ever stick to the rest of us. I'm going to give you an example now that's going to sound partisan. I don't mean for it to. I promise you that when the last president of the United States was president of the United States, I had all kinds of fun at his expense too. But right now, we have the one who we have. So you're just going to have to indulge this little humorous aside because it makes a point. Even if you like the current president, even those who voted for him twice and gave him a lot of money, even he himself would probably acknowledge that he's not the most articulate individual to ever come down the pike. I'm not saying that to be cruel. I'm not saying that as a cheap shot. It is something that we all know, whether you like this president or whether you don't. He regularly makes up words that don't exist, mispronounces words that my five-year-old has absolutely no trouble with whatsoever. And a lot of people think it's cute. They cut him a lot of slack. I run into people all the time who say, well, now I like the fact that he's not slick. I like the fact that he mispronounces. That just makes him a regular guy. Why, if he was still drinking, I'd love to have a beer with him. And other people, yeah, whatever. And other people will say, well, that's just Texas, which is a really funny thing to say about a guy who spent almost all of his life in Connecticut, but that's another issue for another day. The only member of the Bush family to have a Southern accent, but whatever. But here's the point. If this president were a black man and as articulate or inarticulate as this man is, do we not think that folks would indeed view that lack of ability to articulate through a racial lens, that they would in fact have that stereotype triggered in the back of their mind that it had something to do with being black? You know full well that that would be triggered. And you know, I hope, that black folks, every time the president got up and made some kind of silly remark and mispronounced the word, black folks would be like, damn, why are you doing that to us? Every time you screw up a word, because they know that white folks were going to be looking at him the next day at work. That W, that black guy, he's not so smart, you see. But for those of us who are white, it doesn't stick to us. If W mispronounces every third word out of his mouth, it doesn't reflect on us. If that man were Latino or Asian American, they would tell him to go back to his country of origin, learn English before he comes back into the United States. But white men can butcher the English language with regularity, and it's not a problem for the rest of us. It doesn't stick to the rest of us. And we know this is true because if people of color are articulate, God forbid, we got to tell them how articulate they are, right? So it's that, oh, you're so articulate, my goodness, which is really a backhanded way of saying we're stunned because we thought all y'all were idiots, right? It's the Asian American kid who I meet every month in this country who says that, you know, his family's been in the country for four generations. And yet somebody always comes up to them and says, oh my gosh, you speak English so well. Where are you from? Kansas City? No, really. Where are you really from? Kansas City. No, like where are your parents from? St. Louis. Can we stop this now? Right? It's this idea that people of color, when they are articulate, that's shocking. And when they're not, it's representative of a group problem. But white folks, not a problem. Same thing with terrorism. Right? So Tim McVeigh, he doesn't represent white people. Terry Nichols, he doesn't represent white people. The two guys that brought down the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City in 95. The Olympic Park bomber, white guy, Eric Rudolph, he doesn't represent white people. The Unabomber, white guy, sent bombs around the mail for 25 years before they finally caught him. He doesn't represent white people. The 120 white so-called Christians who have bombed or burned abortion clinics in the past 20 years in this country, they don't represent white people. But let 19 guys who were Arab and Muslim fly planes into buildings, and we have otherwise rational people running around saying, we need to profile them all. Because all the hijackers on 9/11 were Arab and they were all Muslim. True indeed. 19 Muslims out of 1.5 billion Muslims on planet Earth. The very definition of a non-representative sample, which is to say that if you draw a conclusion about who the next terrorist is going to be on the basis of those 19, that is what social scientists call sampling error, what I would call statistical illiteracy, and yet we have otherwise decent, rational people saying, that's a good idea, we need to do that. But we didn't do it with white people after McVeigh and Nichols brought down the Oklahoma City Federal Building. I know this for a fact because like a year later, I went into the Ryder truck facility in my town where I was living at the time in New Orleans. Same company McVeigh and Nichols used to kill 168 people. I go in, get the same make and model of truck as the one they used. I walk in, I'm white, I'm male, I have short hair. I was clean shaven at the time. And in case you have paid no attention, my name is Tim. So I fit this profile of the latest, greatest American terrorist five different ways. And they didn't say boo to me. They didn't ask for additional money up front in case I decided to use their property as an incendiary device. They just took it for granted that I wasn't like that other Timothy, right? But why is it we are willing to cut me that slack and not someone whose name is Mohammed, like Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker on 9/11, or simply someone who follows a prophet of that name? Either way, will get you in trouble in this country, and it has nothing to do with actual propensity for violence or terrorism. It has everything to do with racial bias and racialized privilege. But having said all of this about the advantages that those of us who are white have, which we have not earned, I want to suggest that in spite of all of that, that it is still dangerous for us to indulge the privileges. And the reason I want to talk about this for a second before I finish is that many years ago I would do these talks and I would talk about all the privileges that we as white folks had, and folks of color would, like at the end, they would sort of go, yes, Tim, you know, that was a really good talk, man. I figure you probably convinced a whole lot of white people in the room that they have all those privileges that you talked about. Thanks for reminding them. Now, tell us, please, why in the world they'd want to give that up, right? Really good question, because we live in a society that doesn't encourage us to give away an advantage. If we have an advantage, this society says, take advantage of that, multiply that, bank that, right? Use that. It's one of the reasons back in the day, this doesn't happen anymore, but like back in my parents' generation, their parents used to tell them, eat all the food on your plate, there are children starving in China, right? Which, just think about that for a minute. That's an invitation to gluttony, right? Because it's like, yeah, did I mention the people that are dying because they don't have any food? Cool, eat some more, right? Not box up the damn food and send it to China, but eat. Seconds, third, did I mention the dead kids? Yeah, they're dying. Here, have some more. Have some more food. Stuff your face. They're dying, but that's okay. Doesn't affect you. Did I mention that they're dying? Here. Here. It's a whole plate of food, whole table of food. Eat, right? So it's just an invitation to take advantage of advantage, not to give it away. So when this question was asked to me, I remember thinking, that's a really good question. Why in the world would privileged people want to change that system, which seems to be working for us? But I want to give you the idea to take away from here and really contemplate and really think about in the days and the months and the years and your entire lifetime to come, whether or not these privileges, which are very real and give us all kinds of advantages in relative terms, might actually be dangerous for us in other ways and might actually be worthy of our turning against them as well. Not just because we don't want to continue to marginalize people of color, right? Not because of some moral or ethical concern, though those are all valid, but because indeed they're dangerous for us. I want to suggest there are a few reasons that privilege is dangerous to indulge. First, if you look at the history, you know that a system of inequality and white privilege has actually been one of the key factors that has dampened the struggle for economic justice in our country to the detriment of most white people as well. Unless you're in the very, very, very top, that top one, maybe top 5%, pretty much everyone else has been significantly harmed in economic terms by virtue of that system of privilege. How do I know that? Well, for example, if you go back to the time of the colonies, before we were a country, you'll find that you had a lot of poor and working class European people who were indentured servants, right? Just one level above a slave. They were getting their ass kicked every day by the elite. They were getting their clock clean. They didn't have a pot to piss in. They were completely, you know, destitute, barely better off than those who were actually owned as property. Indentured servants were owned for like 7 years, right? And then they could buy their way out of indenture, basically, after that 7 year period. So as a result of the common economic interest of African slaves and oppressed and marginalized European working class folks, on occasion, not as often as should have happened, but definitely more so than we've learned, you would have African slaves and white indentured servants getting together to foment rebellion, to overthrow the aristocratic and elite arrangements within the colonies. What do you think the elite did when they saw black and white folks starting to come together to overthrow oppressive economic institutions? They had to come up with a plan, right? They had to figure out a way to take those white folks and get them on the team with the elite. How do you do that? Well, all of a sudden you get rid of indentured servitude, no more of that. And you take those white workers and you put them on the slave patrol and you have them control the black slaves. Oh, we're gonna give you a little taste of power. Not much, we still don't like you. We still don't really wanna live next to you. We still don't want you to marry into our family. You're still trash to us. But we're going to give you just a little taste of power, and it worked, because now you had white folks who previously had seen their interest as being common with those who were slaves saying, ah, now we're on the white team, and those rebellions diminished dramatically. So here was an example of white privilege being extended to white folks who didn't have anything else going for them, and it kept them from actually fighting for their real interest economically. A generation, two, three, four generations later, under the Civil War era, you have the same thing happen. You have rich white folks in the South announcing publicly the reason that they're seceding from the Union and prepared to foment war is to maintain slavery. Now, today, my people in the South will lie to you and tell you it wasn't about that. And they are lying. Because at the time, they were very clear that was the only reason they ever gave in any speech, in any writing, for why they were leaving the Union, was to maintain slavery and the system of white supremacy. So how do you get poor white folks that don't even own any slaves to go fight to maintain slavery? That is a hell of a trick, man. Because if I was like going to tell you, hey, I got this really nice house and I'd like you to go fight so I can keep it. How's that sit with you? And you'd be like, yeah. No, you wouldn't. You'd be like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm not going to go fight to keep you your house when I don't have a house. But that's what the elite in the South did. They told the poor white folks, you need to go fight for this system, for our way of life. Because otherwise, the slaves, if they're freed, will take your job. Well, no, fool, the slaves already had your job, because if I'm white and I have to charge you a dollar a day to work on your farm and they can get the black guy to do it for free because they own him, guess who's going to get the work? Not the white guy. So in other words, slave labor was actually undermining the economic interest of most white working people and bringing down the wages for all white working people by virtue of having this huge pool of free labor. So indeed, it would have been in the economic interest of white people to overthrow slavery, but they didn't. They went out in the South and fought to maintain it, right? Why? Because they've been given the impression that their relative interest was more important than their absolute interest. And we saw it in the union movement, where you had white union workers, right, who said, we want to maintain the professionalism of our union by keeping out blacks, keeping out Chinese labor, keeping out Mexican labor. So we're going to have a smaller union, but more, no fool, you want a bigger union. Because when you go out on strike, you want more people on the line. When you go negotiate a contract, you want more people, not less. So indeed, they sacrifice their real well-being of working people everywhere just to maintain whiteness as an advantage. So in a very real sense, this system of privilege has extended to white folks this inability to see our own interest as being linked to the interest of people of color. So it's not positive for us either. The second problem with that system of inequality is that it produces a significant amount of anxiety. Because when you have significant inequality in a society, those who are at the top constantly are afraid that someone is coming to take what we have. Whether it's another nation, they're coming to take us. Whether it's immigrants, they're coming to take our jobs. Whether it's terrorists, they're coming to attack us. This constant paranoia that the privilege that the dominant group has. So we've got to get them before they get us. We've got to have this new concept of preventative war. We're going to start a war so that we don't have a war. That's a brilliant idea. We're going to launch a war to stop a war from happening. It's brilliant because we got to get them before they get us. And we got to have three strikes laws. And we got to build a fence on the border, but only the Mexican border, not the Canadian border, because we love them. It's just those brown-skinned people. But we got to get them because they're coming to take what we have. It makes you think that maybe if the society wasn't structured so unequally, we wouldn't be nearly so paranoid, right? But we've been running around for decades saying, we're number one. We're the best. We're better than you. We're America. We kick your ass. We're number one. And we think like people are going to like us for that. Man, if you like went around the playground telling all the other kids that you were number one, they would beat you down, and with a reason. Right? But then we act like we're just going to go tell the whole world that they suck. And they'll like that because we're America. That'll work. And then when it doesn't work, we develop all this anxiety, all this stress. So in June of 2004, there was a study released in the Journal of the American Medical Association with the headline, United States posts the highest rate of mental illness in the world. Now that's stunning. And what mental illnesses were they talking about? Not like organic stuff, not like schizophrenia and stuff like that. They were talking about anxiety disorders, depression and substance abuse. Why would we, the wealthiest, most powerful nation on earth, have more anxiety than any, twice the global average, five times the average in Nigeria, right? I'm thinking that folks in Nigeria are dealing with more absolute stress than most of us are. I'm thinking that folks in Rwanda are dealing with more absolute stress than we are.